Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In a way, it all started with this.
At last, my love has come along. My lonely days are over. And life is like a song. Oh, at last.
That's Kelly Clarkson during her first American Idol audition in Dallas, Texas. She was the first winner of Fox Network's American Idol in 2002, and just 15 million votes were logged the final week of the first season to make Clarkson the winner. By contrast, for the final week of the eighth season, just under 100 million votes were counted during that same period. What if that same enthusiasm were translated to the ballot box on the real election days in this country? Joining us today to talk about those sorts of parallels with politics and what American Idol and its winners really say about us is Catherine Meisel. Catherine is a visiting professor of ethnomusicology at Oberlin Conservatory. She earned her Ph.D. in ethnomusicology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and also holds doctorate, master's, and bachelor degrees in vocal performance. Her book, Idolized, Music, Media, and Identity in American Idol, was released in January. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
To our listeners, have you ever voted on American Idol?
Oh, yes.
Well, I'm going to ask our listeners out there, if you have voted, who did you vote for and what inspired you to participate? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tell us, have you ever voted, who did you vote for, and what inspired you to vote on American Idol? Catherine, you write about a fundamental tension at work in American Idol and in current national politics at large between multiculturalist and assimilationist understandings of American identity. That means, in short form, lots of different people, square blocks, so to speak, trying to fit into that same round hole or, you know, by singing the same songs along the way.
Yes. I think that there is this fundamental tension just in our social lives in general. Everyone who is a first or even second generation American is aware of this tension, that you have to decide how much you're going to retain of something that's maybe unique or that's a non-mainstream identity, and then how much you're going to fit into a generic American way of living or way of being. And this is something that comes out on the show quite a bit because it's always about becoming American, I think, both on the show and in our lives in general. So even if we're born here, it's always about how we become American. What is it that we show of ourselves that is part of this massive culture, and what is different?
What do you know about how the contestants are coached along these lines, or is their coaching strictly a function of musicality, performance, that sort of thing?
Along the lines of identity?
Of identity, correct.
Yeah, I think it's actually one of the most interesting things that I found in the research for my book was that everyone kind of has a hand in that. It's producers have a hand in how people's identities are portrayed on the show. Contestants have a hand in how their identities are portrayed on the show, and sometimes it's a strategy for them, you know, to kind of package themselves in a way where they're marketed, you know, as a certain American identity, you know, representative of a certain American identity. And consumers, you know, the viewers, the people who watch the show and who hopefully will buy the albums at the end of the show, also, you know, by their responses to what they see on television, help to shape these identity packages as well.
My guest is Catherine Meisel. She is the author of a new book. It's called Idolized, Music, Media, and Identity in American Idol. She is a visiting professor of ethnomusicology at Oberlin Conservatory. If you have a question or comment for her, we're talking about American Idol, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Have you ever voted on American Idol? And if so, what did you vote for and what inspired you to participate? Give us a call or email us and tell us. Catherine, that idea of being coached in identity, when the successful American Idol contestants, whether they win or not, but, you know, the finalists, do they tend to be more in touch with their own identity and understand it better than those who fall by the wayside along the way?
You know, that's a tough question. I guess I wouldn't know if they personally understand it better, but I think it definitely ends up being used on the show in a more clear way than for people who don't really make it, you know, into the finals. Or we have to have something as viewers to latch onto to create a niche audience, you know, of people who are going to vote for each contestant. So the more we can identify them in some concrete, tangible way, the better they're going to do. So if we have, like one of my favorite examples was Jasmine Trias in season 3, who came from Hawaii. So her ethnic identity wasn't ethnically Hawaiian, but she was identified on the show, you know, as Hawaiian, and everything she said in her little pre-performance video packages had to do with Hawaiian culture, and she was shown teaching hula dance to, you know, the idol contestants and producers, and that made people just really light up, you know, people who had some kind of identification with that culture, and also with her status as an Asian American, you know, she became a representative for many people, I think she's just one of the best examples of gaining one of those niche markets. And Hawaii was crazy about her. You couldn't make a phone call there on Tuesday night.
There are a lot of stories like that. The ethnicity factor comes into play. What are some others that really stand out for you?
I'm actually wondering about this season. There was just on the first day, I think there was this woman who was from an ethnic Albanian family from Kosovo, mm-hmm. and had come to the United States with her family when she was a child, and they came as refugees. They won the green card lottery, you could say. And there's already been, you know, internet activity of both people from Kosovo and Albanian Americans kind of supporting that. And I mean, it's a really powerful thing to see yourself represented on television, especially if you belong to any kind of marginalized group or any kind of minority. This is another tension, right, because there's a very fine line between the excitement of seeing yourself represented on television when you might not have been otherwise and kind of an exploitation for commercial purposes, right? So there's mm-hmm. always, people are always feeling that kind of, you know, well, it's wonderful to see her on television, but, you know, way to exploit us.
Your book, Idolized, Music, Media, and Identity in American Idol, is a scholarly work. It's a study. It's not just observations and off-the-cuff sensibility about American Idol. It's not just from the point of view of a fan. But you admit you did become a fan of the program after watching it for a couple years.
I did. I definitely did.
How did that happen?
A little bit slowly, but it really was once I started to realize just what kind of cultural impact and what it indicated about America. The more I learned about what it meant, the more it actually meant something to me. And I think when I started, I was actually still a voice major when I started watching it, and when I started watching it really seriously. And I was feeling a little bit snobby about the singing, you know, because that's what opera singers do a lot. Not all the time, but I mean, I actually know several opera singer fans of the show. But there is kind of a tendency to think like pop singing isn't really as well developed or as trained as opera singing. And I kind of had that attitude. But of course, that changed. And I really do think many of the singers on the show are fantastic, fantastic talents. But as I watched, and I really started to feel, first I identified with the contestants as singers, you know, because it's kind of like, I know other singers who said this too, you see these kids and these young adults on the show, and it's just like, you know these people, you know, you went to school with these people, you know, you were in musicals with these people, you mm-hmm. were in operas with them, and they seem really familiar in that way, and then there was more identification as the show went on.
Well, let's listen to in chapter 6 of the book, you get into the idea of identity politics, and as you put it, briefly turned the lens inward to examine your decision on April 18th, 2006, to vote for a certain Elliot Yameen. He was a finalist from Richmond, Virginia. Let's hear him in another performance.
I never felt nothing in the world like this before. Now I'm missing you, and I'm wishing you would come back through my door. Why did you have to go? You could have let me know. So now I'm all alone.
So, Catherine Mizell, you never quite felt like that before, because that was the first time you voted on American Idol.
It was.
I mean, it wasn't for that song, but it was for that person. So what was it?
That was a little bit of a slow build-up also. But, you know, I had been writing by that time, which that was season five, and I had been writing for a couple of years, you know, in graduate school classes about identity in American Idol. And I've been talking to people and researching and figuring out how it was that people voted for Idol contestants, not just based on their aesthetic tastes, or not just based on the fact that they liked someone singing, but also these identity factors that are, again, very, very compelling for viewers. And it hadn't happened to me yet, but I just hadn't identified with anyone outside of, you know, just being a singer. And one of the things about Idol that has gotten a lot of press in the last couple of years is that it has an extremely prominent sort of attachment to Christian ideas and Christian practices, and a lot of the contestants are very openly and very vocally Christian, and there are lots of reasons for that. But I hadn't, you know, I'm not Christian, I'm Jewish, and I hadn't really seen anyone on the show who had talked about that. I think there was a semi-finalist a couple of years into the show who was, but. Now, Elliot also never talked about it, but you knew, okay, if you were Jewish, you knew because of his last name, and that was my first clue, right? And then I think, I don't remember if I went into all of this in the chapter, but there was a series of, you know, of things that happened. So I started thinking, because of his last name, well, he must be, you know, he must be Jewish, and then I happened to be buying an American Idol magazine at Borders. They have a magazine. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And, you know, I was a little bit embarrassed because probably not that many people buy it. But the guy at the counter, the cashier, he looked at the cover, and it had a picture of all of the finalists on it. And he said, is that guy Elliot Yameen still on the show? And I said, yes. And he said, oh, well, he's my cousin's best friend, and I'm supposed to vote for him. I don't watch the show, but I call every week and vote for him. And I said, oh, so you know, so you actually know him. And he's like, well, no, my cousin knows him. And I said, well, do you know?
Well, that's close enough in our culture.
Exactly, yeah. Right, by association. I said, you know if he's Jewish? And he said, oh, yes, yes, he is. And then... And then the Virginia Jewish News, which is a newspaper, voted him, like they had a little article about him. They voted him the Jewish idol, something like that. So it all kind of, you know, there was all this, you knew if you were in the know, right? If you were Jewish, you had this sense. And it was the same with Adam Lambert, like, you know, only Jews cared and only Jews knew. But it was very exciting for us because, again, not represented among pop singers a lot. So, yeah, so it was, I just sort of saw firsthand. There were a couple of other things, too, that made me identify with him. Like, he had, you know, he had health issues. And
he had, he's diabetic, is that it?
Yeah, and, like, some hearing loss, and it just, you know.
But also, you're a musicologist. He's very good.
He is very good, yeah. And he was also not highly trained. You know, it was, there is this sort of mythology around the natural talent on American Idol, which I love. Lee DeWise was like that too, you know, where it's somebody who's maybe not quite as experienced, and they just thought, I like to sing, people tell me I have a good voice, and they go and audition, and, you know, 90% of, at least 99% of those are people that you know, that they dismiss. But every once in a while you get someone who really just does have a natural talent, and that's pretty powerful too.
We're going to have to take a break right now. My guest is Catherine Mizell. She is a visiting professor at the Oberlin Conservatory of Music. She's also the author of a new book. It's called Idolized, Music, Media, and Identity, an American Idol. And in celebration of the 10th season of American Idol, we're talking to her today. So if you have a question or comment for Catherine, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Discover more about All Sides with Ann Fisher online at wosu.org/allsides. You can listen to new and archived shows from all the guests and topics. You can also find All Sides on Facebook and Twitter, subscribe to podcasts, and preview upcoming programs. Discover more about WOSU and All Sides with Ann Fisher at wosu.org/allsides. It's 26 degrees in downtown Columbus with some light snow. Occasional snow showers off and on throughout the day today, and temperatures falling throughout the day as well. Also, wind gusts as high as 40 miles per hour, and you can expect about a half an inch of snow today. A chance of snow tonight and cold with a low of 13 degrees. Sunny for Thursday and a high of 24. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Catherine Mizell. She is the author of Idolized, Music, Media, and Identity in American Idol. The 10th season has kicked off now for American Idol. And if you have some questions or comments that you would like to relate about that to Catherine, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Catherine, you say that the narrative of each show in each of its regional variants, because it's all over the world now, represents real life and real politics renegotiated in song. What do you mean by renegotiated in song?
Well, that's a fancy turn of phrase there.
There's lots of them. I like
an
it.
Academic book, yeah.
Yeah.
There have been something like 42 versions of the show all over the world. Not all of them are still running,
mm-hmm.
But they... all of them have had, you know, some kind of impact where they're aired. And these are either broadcast in one particular country or in a region, and occasionally to people outside the region also who might have satellite TV, but, you know, to particular groups of people. And the reason why the franchise is so successful just in itself, this is not counting the hundreds of other knockoff shows,
mm-hmm.
you know, and other franchises that have sprung up as well. But the reason I think it's so successful is that the producers are so careful to make each show about the people who are participating. You know, I think this particular season, season 10, began with this very dramatic little voiceover and video package where we were told, but it's not our story, it's yours. And that's really the idea. So wherever it is in the world, the issues that are important to people who are watching and people who might be auditioning kind of come out on stage. They get played out on stage. And I think the example that I used the most in the book, I talk about this show Superstar, which otherwise known as Arab Idol, right, which I think it ended in 2008, actually, but was very strong from 2003 till then. And other shows kind of replaced it as it went along. But on that show, there's a kind of, actually, it kind of seems timely to get back to that now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Arab world is suddenly changing extremely drastically right now,
mm-hmm.
as we speak. But when I was writing, there's this sort of, there's been a tension for many, many years. You know, in the 60s and 70s, there was a great movement toward pan-Arabism, you know, this idea of the whole region being united. And there's the League of Arab States, right, which is 22 countries, and that's where the show went out to, and these 22 countries. And at the same time as that idea of pan-Arabism, there's also been a lot of conflict within the region for decades, a very serious military and ideological conflict. And so all of these things kind of played out on the show in the way that people participated in the songs. that were sung on the show were all part of this kind of pan-Arab, music industry. They were all old songs, you know, so the cross-generational thing like we have on American Idol.
Mm-hmm.
But they appealed to everybody, even though people would know, like, that song is associated with Syria or that song is associated with Lebanon or an artist from those places. There was still a sense that it's everybody's music. But at the same time, the voting was it was like in Hawaii, but a little bit more passionate too, which is very hard to say. But you know, like, cell phone companies were offering discounts if you were Jordanian and you voted for, you know, a Jordanian contestant, or, you know, the Lebanese cell phone company would offer a discount if you voted for the Lebanese contestant. And there was a lot of really intense national competition at the same time that this idea of international pan-Arab brotherhood was also played out. So, it was really quite amazing the way that show worked out.
The show is contemporary, and yet it uses older songs often to grab those other audiences, but it doesn't really ever get into current events.
American Idol?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. It doesn't, not explicitly.
I mean, it may, but they just edit it out if it does.
Well, you know, that occasionally the president has been on, like, with
really?
A little,
I didn't
a
know
little
that.
Video package. Yeah, it started in,
weird.
It did not happen until 2007. They did the first Idol Gives Back show, which is a giant charity event.
Okay.
And then the next year it happened too, but so it was kind of inevitable, you know, with this very slow collapse of the boundary between politics and entertainment. It was a little bit inevitable that the president would appear at some point. But just, it was, you know, in support of the charity effort.
Mm-hmm.
But that's happened more than once, and I think it happened last year, too, when they did a charity thing, not quite as big, but they still did it, and President Obama had a video on it as well. So sometimes, I think that's probably where the current events have come in most explicitly, is when they're talking about, like Hurricane Katrina, I think, was the object of the first, one of the main objects of the first Idol Gives Back event, and because it was just after the year after the hurricane and the floods and everything. So it does come up a little bit, but not so much, not as much in music, I guess.
We have a message from Beth on Facebook. She writes, I watched for the first time last year. I voted for Crystal Bowersox because I thought she was incredibly talented, sang from her heart, and of course she is an Ohio homegirl.
That's right.
A point that you've made already. And let's talk a little bit about maybe, I used it at the top of the hour, the losers, I guess. Sometimes they're as important as the winners. Some of the contestants are better known for their moments of failure, and we could take General Larry Platt, for example. I think that was last season.
Yes.
Pants on the ground, pants on the ground, looking like a fool with your pants on the ground, with the gold in your mouth, hat turned sideways, pan hit the ground, call yourself a cool cat, looking like a fool, walking downtown with your pants on the ground, giddy up. Hey, get your pants off the ground.
Wow. I mean, the unexpected, the eccentric, the patently untalented are appealing as well on American Idol. How does that work?
Well, okay, before I answer your question, I just want to tell Beth I'm also a big Crystal Bowersox fan.
Okay.
But, you know, the Ohio thing, yeah. Okay,
yeah.
But losers, right? so I think there are a couple of reasons. One is the most obvious reason, and I don't want to downplay it because I think it is important, that we do like to laugh at people. I mean, you know, not just Americans, but in general, you know, it's something that we get a little bit of perverse pleasure out of.
Kind of like the Gong Show type of.
Yeah. And part of that is, you know, the idea, it's a little bit of a superiority thing, you know, where you're watching TV and you see this happen and you go, well, I could do better than that, you know, which is one thing that inspires people to audition for the show, you know. And then there's another thread, which is really about, you know, just the idea of being famous for a moment, right? Just being on TV, doing something dumb even, at least you're on TV and at least you're famous. So for a moment. So that's something I think that pulls a lot of people in. And then the thing that I talk about the most in the book is how how failure relates to the American dream. And the American dream is something I come back over and over again mm-hmm. to. I'm not really reading that far into it. It's kind of very obvious on the show. Mm-hmm. They even said that, like, the girl I was talking about from Kosovo, they even used the word American dream when they were talking about her. And it's a very, very strong, persistent thread theme throughout all 10 seasons. And for me, there are many, many stories of the American dream that kind of collectively make up this mythology that we're all familiar with. And one of those is the idea that to live the American dream, you have to overcome obstacles, right? You have to fall down in order to, you know, move on up. you've got to fail to succeed. And sometimes on the show, they illustrate this with people who have overcome tragedy and illnesses and accidents and things like that. But I also think that these people that the judges make fun of and that viewers make fun of also tie into that same idea that failure is actually part of the process. Probably the best known example. I mean, General Larry Platt was a good example, but all of the subsequent seasons since season three have built on the incredible success out of failure that William Hung made in season three. So all of these, you know, General Larry Platt and everything, he was pulled in off the street. There's no way he just showed up to audition.
Well, I wondered about that, too. You know, I did not get a cut of William Hung, but he was one of the all-time worst there ever was.
Well, that's what they said. But I think there's so much more to it. I actually got to talk with him, and he was one of my favorite interviews. Because the reason why he was so successful even after he was rejected was, you know, because of his attitude. So aside from the whole, you know, everyone laughing at him thing, there was this element of this great element of sincerity to his attitude and his story. And after the judges dismissed him and Randy Jackson, you know, laughed behind his folder mm-hmm. for 15 minutes about it, he just said, "Well, I did my best."
Right.
I mean, you know, that's
outside in the hallway.
Great.
That's right.
That's great, right? No, even in the audition room. I did my best.
That's right. And that's right.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
And that, I think that really struck a chord with people. He's made three CDs, and I think he had a music video, right. And he's been in films, and he's been on television, he's been in commercials, and I think he's still singing. And actually, I saw him crowned Artichoke King in 2006, which doesn't seem that impressive until you know that Marilyn Monroe was the first Artichoke Queen. So it's actually an honor.
It's not as easy as it looks.
No, right. And so his story is very inspiring, and that's what he said, too, you know, because I asked him why he thought people liked him so much, you know, why he actually became such a phenomenon. And he said he thinks it's probably his attitude and he said, you know, you actually have to overcome struggles to succeed in life. And that's what he demonstrates. And he felt like it might be inspiring to other people who might want to audition for the show. And I have to say a little bit in his defense, because now I've been watching this show for a really long time, and there are people that you might call bad singers and people that you might call bad singers. But remember, you know, I've also taught music for a really long time, too, mm-hmm. and I see all kinds of ranges, and I didn't think that he was really that bad. And when I...
His pitch was okay.
That's the thing, right? When
he
I started looking at his audition, mm-hmm. he sang that song at exactly the same pitch
right.
that the recording is at. And when I talked to him, I asked him if he had received his starting pitch before he sang, and he didn't understand the question. You know, he said, "No, I already knew the song." And he said, "Yeah, but how did you know where to start?" And he said, "Well, I practiced and I knew the song." So he actually has a good ear. And I think he played clarinet when he was a kid. And I mean, it's really...
I noticed that, too.
You know, they just made this whole thing about how terrible he was. And there's something else at work besides, you know, his ability to carry a tune, which he really could do.
We have a couple Facebook messages, one from Lisa. She writes, I have this fantasy about how we do an end run around Congress and fix the federal budget and Medicare and Social Security by putting different programs on American Idol each night of the week and having the American people vote things up or down. It might work better than Washington. What do you think, Anne? What do I think? Well, I don't know. Catherine Mizell, what do you think? The level of participation in American Idol, now granted, you don't have to be, you know, 18 to vote, but it's kind of fantastic how people are so invested in this show and watch it so religiously, yet get them to try to go out two or three times a year to vote for, you know, really important things and forget about it.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a disparity for sure. And I think, you know, you make this point that for Idol, you don't have to be 18. So you can, in fact, be 12 and just own a cell phone.
And you can vote over and over again, too.
You can, and you can, but it's not even quite equal, you know, enfranchisement. Like if you want to vote by text, which is the only way you guarantee that your vote gets through, mm-hmm. you have to have AT&T as a plan. And that doesn't happen with American voters. We like things to be convenient. And we like to know a lot about what we're voting for, and that's one of the issues, one of the reasons why more people don't vote is that we're not constantly exposed to the issues we're voting for or against every Tuesday and Wednesday night, or I guess every Wednesday and Thursday night now. So there is, I think, you know, there's a little bit of a difference. Everything in American culture and possibly, you know, global culture moving toward that direction as well right now is about voting. Everything is about voting, and this is because of Idol. You know, of course, it's not the first show to have voting, but it really just crystallized that idea of consumer choice dressed up like an election, dressed up like the democratic process. So really, we're just choosing what we're going to buy, right, at the end. We're choosing a product, but it makes us feel like we have this incredible amount of power. And, you know, I think that if there's any kind of actual impact on American electoral politics, we might have to wait a little while to see. I was really curious about, you know, so many people turned out for the 2008 election.
Yeah.
I was curious as to whether there was any kind of, you know, direct relationship, but I can't really prove anything like that.
The relationships possibly are technological, and because of social media, it did skew a little bit younger than usual, perhaps, and that also might have to do with the candidate. You know, he was younger, and but it might be technological, and of course, something like American Idol couldn't even exist without the technology we have now that we didn't even have 10 years ago.
Yeah, AT&T actually, an executive there a few years ago made a statement that American Idol had helped to introduce text messaging in the United States, and I think that's absolutely true. In other countries, it was around before. We were a little bit late to the text messaging party, but Idol definitely had a little bit to do with it, at least. And as voters, we like things to be convenient too. That's important to us. And, you know, text messaging and using your landline phone are really easy. You don't have to leave your house. You don't have to go find your polling place. And
don't have to go in the rain.
Yeah.
Or in the freezing rain.
Yeah, exactly.
From Elizabeth on Facebook, she writes, don't watch, never will watch. I am too old to watch. I hope, however, that the fact that so many young people vote for American Idol will transfer to the future election. So they were both sort of like fantasy Facebook messages on that score. We have to take another break. When we return, we'll have some more cuts from American Idol. And also return to our conversation with Catherine Mizell. She is the author of Idolized, Music, Media, and Identity in American Idol. She's also a visiting professor at the Oberlin Conservatory of Music. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News Team.
Once a month in the hills of Perry County, just south of Zanesville, members of the Ohio Defense Force meet inside the abandoned Roseville Prison. Most members say they're normal Americans, just exercising their constitutional rights to own AK-47s and march and train like an army.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins. And amid the partisan rhetoric about health care reform, it's hard to hear the voices of people facing life and death questions every day. We'll talk with award-winning actress Anna Deavere Smith about her one-woman show based on real-life interviews with doctors, patients, and politicians. That discussion begins at 11 right here on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 26 degrees in downtown Columbus with some light snow. Snow off and on throughout the day, and temperatures also falling throughout the day. Wind gusts of up to 40 miles per hour at times, and you can expect a half an inch of snow this afternoon. A chance of snow tonight and cold, a low of 13 degrees. Sunny for Thursday and a high right around 24 degrees. And then clear skies Thursday night and even colder with a low right around 9 degrees. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. It's the 10th season of American Idol. Friend or foe of the program, it is indisputably and had it made an impression on American culture as it reflects American culture. Joining me today, Catherine Mizell. She's a visiting professor at Oberlin Conservatory of Music. She's also the author of Idolized: Music, Media, and Identity in American Idol. If you have a question or comment for us, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you've ever voted on American Idol, I'd love to have you give us a call or email us and tell us why you voted, what inspired you to vote. I've never watched an entire season. In fact, I've really only watched auditions. I don't know why, if that's that they kind of grab me, the auditions, and maybe it's from you know, watching the losers and that whole dynamic. Catherine, let's talk a bit about what the definition of an idol is. The issue of what makes an idol, I guess, reared perhaps its ugly head during season three when the merits of the eventual winner, Fantasia Barrino, were debated. Let's hear Fantasia now. Okay, it's Fantasia. Fantasia's status as an unwed mother and high school dropout brought out the angry in some and the defensive in others. Catherine, what was going on there?
Well, yeah, this is a great question. What actually is an American Idol? And we have this idea that people who are in the public eye, people who are famous, people who are on television and political figures, they have to be role models in some way. For Americans, and especially because so many kids watch American Idol, I think a lot of people have felt like the person who wins or the finalists need to be representative of, you know, a particular way of living. But Fantasia, in spite of having maybe the stigma that worked against her of being an unwed teenage mother, she also was packaged on the show with a particular emphasis on her religious faith. She was really packaged as a gospel singer on that show. She's actually my favorite idol, honestly.
Uh-huh.
Why
is she your favorite?
It was the first season that I watched really, really seriously.
Okay.
To study, and I felt like she just brought out all of these different threads of, you know, what it was like to be on television, to go from being an ordinary person to being somebody famous, and she really seemed like a genuine person. This is actually one of my favorite things about the show, and that viewers, you know, the viewers I've talked to, even when they feel like the show is incredibly fake and commercial, and, I mean, you see the cameras there, you know, it's not like, even if it's called reality television, we understand that it's, there are elements of it that are not reality, and people are afraid that the voting is rigged and all of this, even though there's a great suspicion of the inauthenticity of reality television, people who watch Idol still feel some kind of identification with the contestants, not just based on all of these, you know, ethnic and religious and other identity factors, but because they just seem like real people. Again, they seem like people you might know. In some cases, they are people you know, like those of us from Northwest Ohio, you know, where I was when Crystal was on. And I knew, you know, a lot of my students actually knew her or her family. Mm-hmm. And but that's again, I think that's the great mystery of Idol, is that it's able to balance this incredible skepticism and also this core element of something genuine that is the contestants. And for me, she was just the embodiment of that. She just seemed like a real person. And she's had terrible luck since she was on the show, unfortunately. She's had a really tough time. But
that's right. My guest is Catherine Mizell. She is a visiting professor of ethnomusicology at Oberlin Conservatory. She earned her Ph.D. in ethnomusicology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and also holds doctoral, master's, and bachelor's degrees in vocal performance. Her book, Idolized, Music, Media, and Identity in American Idol, was released in January. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you'd like to join the conversation. And Rick from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and great show as always. And
thank
you very much for coming on to the show, Professor.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Fantastic, gigantic subject to all the things that you could engage. One of the things that's not talked about is, or that concerns me, is the regurgitation or the highlighting of past repertoire. The repertoire itself that is suggested or that's used continues to float these items in the popular culture and does not feature any creativity on behalf of the performers as I could perceive it. That other than stylistic interpretation. I'm also a producer, and I produce vocalists, and it is an amazing phenomena to, for me, to see that there has been no interest in that part of it. Did you find any of the artists themselves after they won were then able to be creative in their own careers?
This is a fantastic point, actually, that you've made. I do get into it in my book, the idea of the cover song. For me, let me see if I can answer all the parts of your very layered question. But for me, the Idol contestants they have to walk this very fine line, this balance between. One of the things they're doing is they are inheriting, you know, this American Idol thing. They're inheriting the pop star status from people who came before them, and so that's where the cover songs come in, right? That they have to prove that they've mastered, you know, the repertoire of very important American singers like Elvis, you know, or they have these theme nights, right? Things have changed a little in the last couple of years, but basically this is the idea, you know. There's a lot of Whitney Houston. If they can prove that they can manage to sing these former number one hits or these former top 40 hits, then they prove to America that they are worthy of inheriting this title, and they prove to producers that they're marketable in some way. But at the same time, like you're saying, if they don't do something stylistically that makes them individual, you know, on the show they constantly say, make it your own, make it your own, make it your own. Mm-hmm. If they don't do that, then they get in trouble, right, for just being a copycat. And so this is a very difficult balance for singers. I really admire the singers on the show for trying to kind of work out that balance. As for their creativity, I heard that this season they're going to start having them do original songs. So I don't know if that's true or not, but I heard a rumor. And it's happened occasionally someone has done an original song, especially early in the season before it gets to, you know, the voting. Sometimes they come into auditions like that, and sometimes they do it in Hollywood. But after the show, you know, they've been attached to Simon Cowell's label, Sony BMG, and they've just switched. Sony BMG is no longer the label associated with Idol, but they were on all these related affiliated labels. And some of the contestants I know, or some of the, not just winners, but people who got contracts after the show, some of them I know worked kind of hard with lawyers to get out of their contracts. I think Clay Aiken did that, and probably several other people as well, Ruben Studdard maybe. And they went on to kind of either co-write or write their own albums. And there's also this kind of... I don't want to go too much onto a tangent, but there's also this kind of split in the way that we talk about music, where rock is different than pop, and rock is all about creativity, and pop is all about everything sounding the same. Like, this is the way we talk about it. It's not necessarily, you know, some kind of honest truth, but this is the way that we see it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so Idol has kind of positioned itself very squarely in the past as pop, but in the last couple of years they've started aligning themselves more with rock singers. So like David Cook and, you know, Chris Allen, maybe on, more on the indie side, and Crystal Bowersox. I mean, these are people who do write their own music. Daughtry, right? He was the first one in season five, yes, to kind of really be associated with that. And now that Steven Tyler is on the judging panel, he also brings this rock credibility to the show. So I feel like they are moving more in this direction of trying to find people who might prove to be original artists, so they might be able to show that on the stage.
Thanks, Rick, for your call. 614-292-8513. We still have a few minutes left. And Pat Wynn Brown, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. This is so great because I'm freezing in my house over here with no electricity. So you warmed me up with all the Idol chatter. I love it, and I love Idol. And my cousin works on the show as a stage manager, Debbie Williams. And I've been to the Idol show, and I was there for the semifinals when Elliot was competing, and I got to meet him, and he is one of the nicest people in the world. He really is a wonderful person. But it was a great thing to watch it from the audience. I really loved watching how they did it, and I loved watching my cousin work with the Idols, because they come from nowhere, and all of a sudden they're thrown into this. And she was also fascinated with our Ted Williams here because of all the fame thrust at him suddenly. And so it probably has not served him well. And she told me about week five with the finalists, she has to have them come to the principal's office, and she sits them down because everybody knows their name, and their heads get real big, and they're famous all of a sudden, and people are giving them stuff, and she has to sit them down and give them a talk about being nice to other people, and that on your way up, these are the same people you're going to see on your way down. So be nice to the crew, because she was a child star. She was an ice skater in Holiday on Ice all her life as a kid, a family act. So it was just really cool to see that show in person. And I'm liking the new judges very much. I think Steven Tyler's hilarious.
I've only seen it a couple times in preparation for this show, and I was surprised at how much I liked him, too.
Yeah, and Jennifer Lopez is nice, and she's a lot more sane than Paula, and I think that helps. And I did tell Debbie, because I tell her stuff all the time, I said, tell Randy to get a thesaurus, because he only uses four words to describe these singers, and he's using a lot more vocabulary words this year, and he's so smart about music. So it's great to hear his analysis, and it's great to see them really focus on the singer, the song, rather than their own image and, you know, creating pretend trouble so the audience will watch. I've really gotten a kick out of it this season. I'm a fan. I'm not ashamed to say it. I love it. In fact, it's the only thing I'm living for. If Idol goes on here, I don't know.
Well, that is not true. We all know it, because Pat Wynn Brown is, of course, the creator of Hair Theater. Pat, thanks so much for your call.
You're welcome. And tell AEP to get over to my house. We're freezing here.
Thanks, Pat. Catherine, let's talk about the judges. The judges always have been part of the show. Simon Cowell, at the time a mere recording executive, was the scariest. And after her first audition with Randy Jackson, Paula Abdul, and Cowell, Kelly Clarkson, who was the first winner, reflected on the experience. Let's listen to that.
And I was, you know, kind of showing off my personality a bit and ended up switching places with Randy somehow. Look, I'll take your place.
You sit down.
And he ended up auditioning for me, Paula, and Simon. I thought it was really cool because I was sitting next to Paula. And they liked it. They all were like, I mean, I was so happy because the British man didn't make me cry.
Okay, that's back when Simon Cowell was still the British man. And everyone was petrified of that guy very quickly, very early on. And folks thought that without that, the show wouldn't be much.
Yes, I guess we're going to see this season. He definitely provided, a couple of things. You know, I've always thought, at least I've been reflecting on this since he announced that he was leaving, that Simon Cowell, he's been providing a model for us as viewers. It's not just that he's sitting there judging Americans, but he's also providing this model for us to judge as well. So he kind of has been teaching us how to judge. But he, you know, the fact that he's British, I think, is actually kind of important. The show, of course, is, the people who develop the show are British, including him, and which is one of the most surprising things, you know, when you think about how cleverly and how intensely they've pushed this idea of the American dream and everything. He's not there anymore, so we have no one British to judge us. It's like the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. And he also, you know, he provided this conflict, this great conflict. Like, he was the obstacle you had to overcome when you're talking about overcoming obstacles. And now we don't have that. So I felt like this year we might have lost the plot, because that's a really big, you know, kind of plot point for this show. But I think that the judges, the new judging panel, have just started to, they seem like they are just starting to kind of come together a little bit and mm-hmm. form a cohesive unit, and their dynamics are kind of getting worked out. And while I can't really make any kind of definitive statement because they haven't really had a chance to shine yet, there's a lot that I think is still familiar to us. So, you know, Steven Tyler, he's a little unpredictable. He's the rocker, right? Mm-hmm. If there's going to be any kind of scandal, it's probably going to be from him. You know, already there people are talking about how he's looking at the young girls and he's swearing all the time. And but it's, you know, he speaks in a sort of non sequitur way sometimes, which mm-hmm. we're very used to from Paula Abdul.
He's even an unpredictable rocker.
He is, right? Exactly. And he, you know, the leering at young women Simon Cowell used to do also. So that stuff's familiar. And while nobody's been really nasty yet, you know, like Simon used to be, we still like get the authenticity that he brought as an A&R executive with Steven Tyler's rock cred. And Jennifer Lopez, I don't want to discount her, because she is, in addition to being a pop star, you know, a really savvy businesswoman, and she's been very successful. So we get that authenticity, too.
Catherine Mizell, we've run out of time.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thanks for joining us. Sorry to all of our callers and the rest of our emailers. There were more questions that I wanted to get to, too. Catherine Mizell, she's the author of Idolize, Music, Media, and Identity in American Idol. She is a visiting professor at the Oberlin Conservatory of Music. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.